When we look at empire today, I think there's one word that encapsulates the bloodshed associated with empire, and that's Iraq in 2007. Like in Vietnam, the American empire in Iraq, the greatest military power in human history, has encountered the limits of its ability to impose its will on a people who do not welcome, not surprisingly, its intervention, which is brutalising, repressive and extremely deadly. And it's in this context that we look at the previous great empire of the world, the British Empire. Because with the Americans in trouble as a result of resistance to its global domination, there's been a major rewriting of the history books in regard to the British Empire. This revisionism of Britain's role in the world through its empire, which was built on slavery and war, centres on the argument that the British Empire somehow enhanced global welfare, and therefore the Americans have a lot to learn from the British Empire, their model of empire, for the American Empire to actually go forward today and succeed. To respond to this revisionism that the British Empire brought liberty and good to the world, I'm going to go through, unfortunately, I can imagine such a big topic, can only briefly touch on a few things. Go through some of the key roles that slavery played in building the British Empire, and look at a couple of examples of this welfare British Empire style. Like all empires, there's been no shortage of bloody wars, even from the civilised and noble British. However, much like today in America, I want to stress right through this empire building that the beneficiaries of this empire were a tiny ruling elite, the ruling class, not the vast majority of people in Britain who actually suffered, from horrendous class oppression. So, the British Empire was certainly impressive. At the height of its power by the late 1890s, it covered about a quarter of the world's land surface. Over 400 million people lived under its sway. It had conquered India in the last half of the 18th century, systematically draining it of revenue using exorbitant land taxes, and as a staging ground to project its power into the region, throughout the Asian region, particularly into China, which it forcefully opened to free trade in the mid-1800s in the infamous Opium Wars. These wars were due to the fact that the smuggling of opium into China by the British was the source of huge profits. In fact, it financed the entire British Empire in the East. Put simply, the British Empire was the largest drug pusher the world ever seen to this day. The Empire controlled parts of Australia, all of Australia, New Zealand, a string of islands in the Pacific. In Africa, Britain conquered Egypt, Sudan, Uganda, Kenya, Nigeria, northern and southern Rhodesia, which is today Zimbabwe, southwest Africa, which today is Namibia, and South Africa. Like all empires, it conquered using brute force and on playing on the divisions of those it subdued. And actually, the empire maintained its rule in the same way. Ideologically, it justified its rule by arguing that the vast majority of the world's people were racially inferior, incapable of ruling for themselves. Sounds familiar. And in some of those countries, such as Australia and South Africa, the British set up white settler colonial states, replica societies, stocked with, white British, and also a few Irish as well. So conveniently, the British considered Australia and New Zealand terra nullius, as if the Aboriginal people didn't exist. This laid the groundwork for the genocide that's occurred. However, I want to now talk about the slave trade to the British colonies in the Caribbean, and argue why it was central in the building of the British Empire. So some facts around that. Between 1500 and 1800, an estimated 30 million black people were enslaved. Britain wasn't the only country that did slavery initially, but it became the best and monopolised the trade. 30 million black people were enslaved, taken from their homes, often at gunpoint, chained hand to foot, loaded like cargo aboard waiting ships. They were branded with the mark of their new owner, sold naked in the markets like cattle, then shipped off to work in plantations for up to 18 hours a day for the rest of their short lives until they died. It's not surprising then that the age of slavery is something that the ruling class prefer to forget. And we've just had Tony Blair this week actually refuse to apologise on behalf of the British state for slavery. In a lengthy history of Liverpool, once the world's largest slave port, in its history it divided just 28 lines to the trade that actually put this city on the map. And the history concluded that the slave trade was to bring benefits to all, not least the transplanted slaves whose descendants have subsequently achieved, in the New World, standards of civilization far ahead of those compatriots who they left behind. So the slavery benefited from being the slave? No way. Of course this is not the case. The real benefactors were the slave owners, the mayors, the judges, the ruling elite, the MPs. They made their fortunes from the trade in human misery. In 18th century Britain, the number of slaves owned was a marker of social standing in Britain. And the parliamentary West Indian pro-slavery lobby could count on, at any time, up to 60 or 70 MPs. You know, they're basically, you know, to back up. But I also want to make the argument that slavery wasn't some peripheral economic activity. It actually was, it was to provide the vast chunk of capital needed for the development of British capitalism. The cotton mills of Manchester, the ironworks of the Midlands, the banking and commercial sectors of London all grew on the markets and profits generated by slavery. So at the time when philosophers influenced by the ideas of the Enlightenment may have been talking about equal rights in the coffee houses of Europe and Britain, the Sweden coffee they drank was produced by the people who had been herded at gunpoint onto ships in West Africa. The standards are taken across in the most appalling conditions. The standard space per slave was 5 foot long, 11 inches wide and 23 inches high for a voyage lasting 9 to 10 months. One of the ship's doctors described some of the conditions, and this is the bloody history, so I want to, you know, try and give some people a sense, you know, of what this empire did. He talked about those who are emaciated have their skin, even their flesh, entirely rubbed off by the motion of the ship, so as to render their bones in those parts quite bare. The deck, that is the floor of their rooms, was so covered with blood and mucus, which had proceeded from them in the consequence of flux of dysentery, that it resembled a slaughterhouse. As a warning to others, those that that would not eat or physically rebelled faced a variety of tortures designed to kill slowly. Slaves were frequently whipped until they could not even let out a whimper, and then left tied to the deck to be exposed to the elements, the heat, the rain, and so on. There were even cases of entire shiploads of slaves just being thrown overboard because actually the ship's owners could claim them as a loss, you know, against their insurance policy. Women slaves endured an even further burden. They were treated as objects of sexual gratification of their masters and frequently raped and, you know, and so on. Many killed themselves and their unborn babies rather than giving birth to the offspring of their oppressors. In his classical book, Capitalism and Slavery, Eric Williams, and I really recommend for people that want to do further reading, this is a really good book that people should read. He actually showed the role that Negro slavery and the slave trade had provided the capital which financed the Industrial Revolution in England and how it was central to the development of British capitalism and hence empire. The triangular trade, which was the main form of trade for Britain in the 17th and 18th century, has been described as the spring and parent whence the others flow, the first principle and the foundation of all the rest, the mainspring of the machine which set every wheel in motion. In this triangular trade, England provided and supplied the exports and ships, Africa the human merchandise, the plantations, the colonial raw materials. The slave ship would sail from England with a cargo of manufactured goods. They would be then exchanged at a profit on the coast of Africa for Negroes, who were then subsequently transported across to the British colonies to be set, you know, to be put to work on the plantation. Then, at another profit, they would get a profit from selling that. then all the produce from the tropics and so on would then be taken across back to Britain to be processed and so on. So hence, you know, creating more industry back in the UK. So as this and the trade like massively increased. And there was also direct trade between the colonies and the West Indies, but it was still never supplanted the need of the slaves in there. So this triangle trade actually gave a triple stimulus to British industry, to the capitalists, and that is, you know, that was really important from the British point of view. And the plantations themselves created another market for the British. By 1750, there was hardly a trading or a manufacturing town in England which in some way wasn't connected directly to this colonial triangular trade. The profits obtained provided one of the main streams of the accumulation of capital needed to finance everything that was going on in Britain. The West Indian Islands became the hub of the British Empire, of immense importance to the prosperity of the British ruling class. And there was also, you know, the slave trade also paid for impressive, grandiose kind of ruling class monuments back in the UK as well, you know, like the cathedral-like library at Oxford University, you know, a place there and so noble and stuff, but you just think of the history of what, you know, the slave trade actually financed it. The grandiose royal crescent in Bath, the enormous West India docks in London. But so often the case in human misery and so on, where there's oppression, there's always resistance. I mean, that's what drives us all here, hopefully, to be wanting to change the world. And this certainly was the case with slavery. As early as October, and I want to give a few examples of this resistance, so it's sort of little stories, I suppose, to try and give people a little glimpse into what it was like. In October 1736, a slave conspiracy was discovered on the Caribbean island of Antigua. It was an extensive plot that had the support of a large number of slaves, both from Africa and Antiguan born. The intention was to blow up the governor and the planter elite at their annual coronation balls, you can imagine. One of the slave leaders, a guy called Tomboy, was a highly skilled carpenter, had ready access to this ballroom, and this plot was going to go along that he was going to plant gunpowder hidden in the cellar, and when it exploded under the ballroom, this would be a signal for an uprising to begin. The whites would be destroyed and an African kingdom established. Unfortunately for them, this stupid coronation ball got postponed, and the plot was discovered, and unfortunately, the ringleaders were rounded up. For the whites, or the planters, the elite on the island, this was a terrifying shock that such a plot could be exposed, because there were 3,000 whites on the island and 24,000 blacks, so black slaves. And moreover, some of these ringleaders were their most trusted slaves. Confronted with this situation, the British responded typically with absolute incredible ferocity. Although 88 slaves, altogether 88 slaves, were to be executed for their part in what some of the judges described as that unparalleled hellish plot. 5 were broken on the wheel, 77 were slowly burnt to death, and 6 were gibbeted. They were hung up in cages and just left to die of thirst and starvation. And this isn't an isolated, this is just the run-of-the-mill sort of everyday happenings in the British Caribbean and their slave trade. Resistance from the slaves took many forms, ranging from sort of low-level day-to-day resistance to sort of labour discipline through to full-scale rebellion. One historian described it as this: slave and masters were engaged in a permanent war, a cold war that took place every day in many forms, that from time to time burst into violent confrontation. I just want to read a passage about Jamaica from this really good book as well that everyone should definitely look at for a few examples. Few slave societies present a more impressive record of slave revolts than Jamaica. During more than 180 years of its existence as a slave society, hardly a decade went by without a serious large-scale revolt threatening the entire system. Between these large efforts were numerous minor skirmishes, endless plots, individual acts of violence, against the master and other forms of resistance, all of which consistently pressed upon the white ruling class the fact that the system was a very precarious one, held together entirely by the exercise of threat of brute force. From the very beginning of the occupation of the island, the British actually did face what was called a maroon problem, the presence of armed runaway blacks who had established hidden communities outside white control, and were actually successful in resisting the British military. And they also offered sanctuary to escaped slaves. But the most decisive episode in the overthrow of slavery in the British Caribbean was the Great Jamaican Revolt that began on the 27th of December 1831. And the slaves had been planning this revolt from as early as April that year. So you can just imagine just how organised it was and so on. So it's none of this rubbish that's been commemorated by some sections of the British ruling class this week, that the 1807 abolition vote in Westminster was the real ending of slavery. It was the slaves themselves that resisted, and it was some number of years after 1807. In this uprising, we included more than 60,000 slaves that engulfed an entire area of 750 square miles, causing immense material damage, costing many lives. And as I said, it was well organised and so on. And again, it shows just how large-scale some of these rebellions were. This history is often written out. And it came at a time when there was increasing hardship. As if slavery could get any harder, but like they were increasing the labour discipline, the exploitation, trying to, you know, just cut down, you know, people's living standards. And I suppose this is many of the slaves actually went to death, you know, defiantly. One of them, Patrick Ellis, told his firing squad to fire, for I will never be a slave again. So you just imagine just these conditions for someone to be saying this just before their death. The other consequence of British welfare, civilization style, a direct product of slavery, is, and this Atlantic slave trade, is how racism evolved from this. And I think it's important, looking at the British Empire, to quickly touch on this, because it's such a profound ruling class ideology used today that can be definitely given, we can thank the British for developing it. Because it's a common argument that slavery was a result of a racist worldview. But again, Eric Williams challenged this. He wrote that slavery was not born of racism, rather racism was the consequence of slavery. So slavery took off on a massive scale because of the commercial cultivation of crops in the Caribbean, as I've mentioned earlier. But these crops demanded a massive labour force that simply free immigrants from Europe were not going to be able, you know, weren't prepared to provide. At first, plantations were actually, plantation owners used what was called indentured servants from Europe, in effect white slaves. These were people that had massive debts to capitalists or other rogue elements of society, or were just simply kidnapped. It was actually very common in Britain just to kidnap people off the streets at this time, and before, you know, you wake up and fuck, you're on your way on a ship, these white people. So, unfortunately for the capitalists, though, this white indentured labour could not meet the demand that was needed, you know, in terms of this huge labour force that was needed. So that is actually when they turned to Africa as a source of slavery. So it was nothing to do with skin colour or anything like that. It was purely an economic decision. At first, white and black slaves were treated very similarly. However, it became clear that white servants or slaves and black slaves who worked together, socialised together, could fight back together. And this concern was highlighted by the Bacon's Revolt in Virginia in 1676. It showed how poor whites and Africans could unite against their landowners. The response from the colonial landowners was to push through a whole series of measures to keep them divided. You know, and that was really one of the key things that they that they had to do, because they could say, oh fuck, you know, this is going to be a real problem if everyone sort of works together. It is true though that like it became overwhelmingly black, the slave trade and so on. So the other problem confronting a lot of these noble and Christian landowners was that, of all things, the Bible used to say that a good Christian man could never ever enslave another man. So they had to get around this somehow. How did they get around this? Oh, to suggest that black people were not humans. They're a form of animal. And we can see, just quickly, we have to move on here, that this idea has been refined. It's been refined to, well, given theoretical boost by social Darwinism and science, some forms of science, and of course was expanded by the British to justify their occupying many people from all around the world, so it wasn't just Europeans, or white British, the Irish as well, suffered from it. And I want to now talk about and move on to talking about Britain's first colony, and that is Ireland. A full-scale rebellion against British rule occurred in Ireland in 1798, and it was put down with, like, immense violence. And also the deliberate encouragement of sectarian conflict. So again, you can sort of see the key aspects that get used. But there was a mass movement, clearly. It was called the United Irishmen, an underground movement of both Protestants and Catholics that mounted a very powerful revolutionary challenge. It was just one chapter, one very bloody chapter, in a long history of resistance to Britain, to British rule in Ireland. And unfortunately, I can't really go into it that much, because I want to talk about something else that happened in Ireland that the British did. But you don't even have to be a radical to draw conclusions about what the British were doing in Ireland. In 1844, a young Tory MP, Benjamin Disraeli, told the House of Commons that anyone looking at the conditions of Ireland, with its starving population, absentee aristocracy, alien church, and the weakest executive in the world, would inevitably conclude that the remedy was revolution. And I concur, and here's some conservative, you know, ruler in Westminster saying this. But it was the Great Irish Famine of 1848 that was one of the more bloody episodes of what the British did in Ireland. Officially it was caused by a potato blight, a fungus that destroyed it, and in fact this famine was it is to this day Western Europe's worst modern peacetime catastrophe. More than 1 million people died of starvation, disease and exposure, and another 1 million fled their homeland as refugees. But how did the richest country in the world, the workhorse of the world, and the ruler of the great empire, how did it respond? The Irish poor were sacrificed on the altar of free trade and economic liberalism. The British government was committed to laissez-faire, free trade and market forces, even to the extent of refusing to introduce such elementary measures as banning food exports from Ireland. Earlier measures of food relief and public works put in place from previous famines were actually stopped, and the provision of food was left to the free market. John Mitchell was radicalised by this famine. He was involved in the Young Ireland movement and produced a newspaper, the Nation newspaper. And I just want to quickly read some of the conditions that he talked about. He described how families, when all was eaten and no hope left, took their last look at the sun, bolted up their cottage doors, that none might see them die nor hear their groans, and were found weak afterwards skeletons. How the law was vindicated all this while, and many examples made, how starving wretches were transported to places like Australia for stealing heinous crimes like stealing vegetables by night, and how every one of these years, 46, 47, 48, Ireland was exporting to England food to the value of £15 million. So that's back then. Imagine how much that would be worth in today's currency. He also wrote, insane mothers began to eat their young, who died of famine before them, and still fleets of ships were sailing with every tide, carrying Irish cattle and corn to England. This is what free trade did for Ireland in those days. He also went on to sort of mill at the idea that this would never occur or be allowed to occur in places like France or Britain, but then came to the conclusion that it was Ireland's colonial position was the key. That was them being a colony and occupying what made them different to the treatment of even the oppressed in other countries. But the treatment of famine victims in such an inhumane way was certainly not just isolated to Ireland. Under the 120 years of British rule up to 1900, India experienced 31 serious famines. This was compared to just 17 in the previous 2,000 years. At least 15 million died in the famines of 77, 78, 89, 1892, 1897 and 1900, not to mention all the ones in the 20th century, as late as the 1940s. And this is a direct result of British policy. It was a direct result of the level of increase in exploitation on a day-to-day basis of the peasant masses. There was a forced policy of the production of raw materials and of food for export. So this massively reduced the ability, made it impossible for peasants and the masses to actually grow their own food. Figures show that even during the worst famines, Indian food exports actually rose. And here's some of the, you know, the ruling class always justifies things when they do horrendous things in the opposite. The railway system, we always go on about how the British brought civilization and so on, built with Indian labour, of course, was touted for its ability that would eliminate famine in India. But it actually was designed to bring food to the ports to be exported, not for starving Indians. One of the British officials in charge of the relief effort to this famine actually explained his unwillingness to help the starving masses. This Lord Edward Lutton stated, "The doctrine that in a time of famine the poor are entitled to demand relief would probably lead to the doctrine that they are entitled to some relief at all times. So the logic being, don't give them anything." This year is the 150th anniversary of the Great Indian Rebellion of 1857. The violence which the British used to put down the rebellion has probably only been approached in even the bloody history of the British Empire a couple of times. That was putting the Irish down in the 1790s and what they did in Kenya in the 1950s in terms of just, I suppose, descriptions at least anyway. It's been written down in history. And this is what one of the soldiers who was there in his memoirs spoke about. His name was Thomas Lowe, and in his Central India during the rebellion of 1857 and 1858, he laments that on one occasion the column in which he was serving had become encumbered with prisoners. And while the policy was to take no prisoners, he told his readers that we must remember that the flesh and blood, even of the hardy Anglo-Saxons, cannot go on slaying from sunrise to sunset. However willing the spirit may be, physical force cannot endure it. Soldiery tire in the limb after great exertion, as well as other good people. And thus it happens after battle when the animal spirit is exhausted by heat and long continued excitement that many prisoners must be made." So unfortunately they had to take prisoners rather than kill them straight away. But it moves on. Not to worry though, on this occasion, all 76 men at the end of the day were actually tied, sentenced and executed straight away. And this is what they did right across India. Historian Michael Edwards, who spent his life looking at Indian historian and stuff, argued that during the Indian Rebellion, the English threw aside their mask of civilization and engaged in a war of such ferocity that a reasonable parallel can be seen in our times with the Nazi occupation of Europe. The British conquest of India began in the 18th century and was completed in the 19th century. Like all great empires, by just a succession, wave after wave after wave of bloody wars. So in a 30-year period, just to quickly go through, there was an invasion of Burma in 24. There was, this is quite amusing, the disastrous invasion of Afghanistan in 1839 and 42. Doesn't this sound familiar? In 43, 44, present parts of India were occupied. There were bloody wars against the Sikhs to try and control Punjab and various other areas, and that was finally completed in 1849. And then again in 52, 53, they started, we had to invade Burma again. So these wars weren't just, these wars were absolutely brutal. They laid the countryside to waste. The cities were absolutely sacked. Civilians were robbed, raped, murdered. Tens of thousands were killed, mutilated. One contemporary person wrote that the siege of Multan in 1848, that "seldom or never in any part of the world has a city been exposed to such terrific shelling as the doomed city." So it really, what this succession of aggression, not just in India, but right through the history, really does show the predatory, brutal and bloody nature that the British state had to undertake to build its empire. So in conclusion, I just want to mention that the British Empire was absolutely built on blood. That the British were the best at dominating the slave market, monopolising it. They actually supplied other empires and so on with slaves. They were the most ruthless slave masters. Put simply, they were the best capitalists. They knew how to accumulate wealth through the whip and through the gun. They were the best at killing, and they were the best at the best at knowing how to screw people over and so on, divide, use racism and ideology. For anyone today that argues, and there's a lot of historians around that try and argue that the British did bring civilization and enhance global welfare, really, they have the evil intent of being apologists for the system. They stand on the side of actually supporting what the Americans are doing. They stand on the side of empire and screwing over people. We in this room stand on the side of those people that actually are oppressed and fight back, to this horrendous empire and so on. And actually, our side will one day win. And you can see the British Empire did actually get defeated eventually and so on. And we want to continue to resist against imperialism, colonialism, and hopefully, win a world that's free away from all this disgusting empire building and really the most raw way that capitalism operates.